Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. People have been diving into the water, searching for buried treasure, ever since the first ship, or dinghy, or log sank beneath the surface. Now, to the best of my knowledge, no major shipwrecks have occurred in the muddy Milwaukee River, and yet people will occasionally don their scuba gear and go searching the riverbed for treasure. Only, it's a very specific kind of treasure. See, legend says that the master recordings of some of the rarest, most historic blues artists of the 1920s might be at the bottom of that river. Well, we'll see if we can separate fact from fiction as we look at the history of Paramount Records, subject of a massive box set of classic blues, none of which were rescued from a watery grave. We also have live music from the Caribbean-inflected Brooklyn-based electropop ensemble known as Busca Buya. But first, it's time for another of our special guest curated playlists that we call Pick Three.
Three, that's a magic number.
Three.
Yes, it is. It's the magic number.
Joining us with a Pick 3 playlist today is Billy Collins, Poet Laureate of the United States from 2001 to 2003 and Poet Laureate of New York State for two more years after that. I don't know what exactly is involved in the day-to-day life of a Poet Laureate, but it sure does sound important. His latest collection is called Aimless Love, and today Billy Collins joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What does a Poet Laureate do?
Not as much as you'd think. The National Poet Laureate gives a reading and a lecture at the Library of Congress once per term. And basically that's it. But you do have the human and material resources of the entire library at your disposal. So
It's
an opportunity to do something big about poetry.
Well, I'm just impressed that New York State has a Poet Laureate.
Well, don't be too impressed because let me make you less impressed. It's one of, I think, 37 states that have Poets Laureate, which is the plural.
Right.
Fair enough. But also there are County Poets Laureate and almost Zip Code Poets Laureate.
Well, you're almost the New York City Subway Poet Laureate.
Well, that's right. I had the honor, really, of being commissioned, not for anything, but just told to do something, commissioned to write a poem on the 100th anniversary of Grand Central Terminal, which happened last year.
Yep.
And so I wrote a little poem, and that was appeared on about 2,500 subway cars and on the back of some Metro cards.
Yep, I had it.
Yeah, great. And I confess to, every time I got on a car, I'd check my poem. And I wouldn't look for a car before I got on that had my poem. But it was gratifying to see it.
Yeah. So you've picked an interesting playlist for us today. Music seems to work its way into your poems on more than sparing occasions.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's a kind of obsession, but it is in the air all the time. I mean, there are a lot of dogs in my poem and mice, and there's a lot of weather. I think it's basically that, as poets, we're all looking for new metaphors or new points of insertion, so to speak, and music is a good way to start. I have a poem called I Chop Some Parsley while listening to Art Blakey's version of Three Blind Mice. But that's really more about wondering how the mice became blind. it does get into my poem.
Well, and in this new collection, Aimless Love, there's a letter to Antonin Dvorak thanking him for sparing you the indignity of watching some crappy movie on a flight to Seattle.
Right.
And More Than a Woman, the name of the poem, where you talk about some horrible pop song so bad you're not even going to name it.
Yeah, right.
Well, that gets stuck. It's a description of an earworm.
That's one poem. It's the only poem I think I've written that the reader can supply the title. I mean, you could call it Dancing Queen, Tainted Love. John, by mentioning these titles, I can activate the song. That's the problem with some of these catchy songs.
Yeah, well, I've had more than a woman going through my mind okay. like all afternoon. So thank you, Billy Collins. Okay. Let's clear that out with the first of your songs on the playlist. Who is Precious Bryant?
Well, I don't know much about her. I know she's from the South, I believe, and she's a blues singer more. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And not too recently deceased either. You know, she's not
right. Just her. Yeah, I read her obituary was in the Times within the last year or two. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she appears in one of the poems in the collection. Would you read that to us as a way of setting this up?
Sure. I mean, she kind of had me from the title of this song. I think just it's a wonderful romantic concept. And her song is called, and the title of my poem is also, "Fool Me Good." I am under the covers waiting for the heat to come up with a gurgle and hiss and the banging of the water hammer that will frighten the cold out of the room. And I am listening to a blues singer named Precious Bryant singing a song called "Fool Me Good." "If you don't love me, baby," she sings, "would you please try to fool me good?"
I love my baby, and I love my baby. I love my baby. Don't you know I love my baby? If you don't love me, baby, would you fool me good?
I am also stroking the dog's head and writing down these words, which means that I am flying calmly in the face of the Buddhist advice to do only one thing at a time. Just pour the tea. Just look into the eye of the flower. Just sing the song, one thing at a time, and you will achieve serenity, which is what I would love to do as the fan blades of the morning begin to turn.
He loved me on the Monday, you know he loved me too. He loved me on the Wednesday, and Thursday he sure do. And I love my baby, oh well I love my baby. I love my baby, don't you know I love my baby. If you don't love me, baby, would you feed me good?
If you don't love me, baby, she sings, as a day moon fades in the window and the hands circle the clock, would you please try to fool me good? Yes, precious, I reply, I will fool you as good as I can, but first I have to learn to listen to you with my whole heart, and not until you have finished will I put on my slippers, squeeze out some toothpaste, and make a big foamy face in the mirror. Freshly dedicated to doing one thing at a time, one note at a time for you, darling, one tooth at a time for me.
But it knows when you treat me right, and I love my baby. Oh, well, I love my baby. I love my baby. Don't you know I love.
That's some good stuff.
There's not much to the lyrics, really.
You know,
there's a lot of repetition in there, but I just think when she swings around to this, it's a very jumpy little strumming guitar, as you said, kind of Piedmont style.
Yeah, that's definitely the Piedmont style, yeah.
But also it's this pathetic condition that, you know, even if you don't love me, fool me, you know, deceive me.
Yeah.
Asking to be deceived. For one of these songs, right, there are 10,000 songs complaining about being deceived. And here's a woman who's so desperate that she wants to be deceived is better than nothing.
Right. That's Precious Bryant and her song, "Fool Me Good." My guest is Billy Collins, the two-term Poet Laureate of the United States and Poet Laureate of New York State from 2004 to 2006. "Aimless Love" is the latest collection, selected poems, a whole bunch of new poems. And, you know, you are known for writing in a kind of very clear, direct way. When you listen to a song, do you bring a poet's ears to the lyrics, or can you sit back and just be a listener?
Well, I think the creatures are very different, you know, song lyrics and poetry. Song lyrics that would get along without the music would be very special cases. I think if Precious Bryant read the lyrics to that song over and over again. Mm. I sure love my baby. I sure love my, it would fall kind of flat.
Yeah.
So there's a higher degree of a higher standard of sense, I think, in poetry. I mean, there are some rock and roll songs that don't make any sense that they're still very good, like A Whiter Shade of Pale. I have no idea what that means. It's one of my favorite songs. I don't care what it means. And there's also I Shot the Sheriff, But I Didn't Shoot the Deputy. What kind of a defense is that? I mean, so this guy needs a lawyer, you know? And one of my other favorites is Rock the Boat, Don't Rock the Boat, Baby. I mean,
make up your mind.
Are we doing both here? Anyway, but those songs, I've never stopped to be annoyed that they don't make a lot of sense. They're great. They're great, catchy songs. But in poetry, if it said that, I think you'd feel you need a higher level of sense.
Billy Collins is with us here in the Soundcheck studio, sharing a Pick 3 playlist with us today. Music does occur in your poems with some frequency, and as you've said, you listen to many different types of music, but jazz seems to occupy a special place for you. Is that?
Well, I'd say most of the listening I do is to jazz, and I've been listening to it since I was about 14 years old, and basically listening to the same jazz. I mean, I think the kind of the best year for jazz was 1957 or around there, and that music still sounds incredibly fresh to me.
There, in your poem, Tipping Point, it says at home, the jazz station plays all day. And the next song that you've picked for us is a classic by Thelonious Monk, and this too has a poem that sort of sets it up for us.
Yeah, there's a song. Shall I just read the poem?
Sure.
Okay. It mentions several kinds of music, but it starts out with that. It's called Snow, and I think snow is the weather that, for me, is most conducive to writing poetry. Snow. I cannot help noticing how this slow monk solo seems to go somehow with the snow that is coming down this morning, how the notes and the spaces accompany its easy falling on the geometry of the ground, on the flagstone path, the slanted roof, and the angles of the split rail fence, as if he had imagined a winter scene as he sat at the piano late one night at the five spot playing Ruby, My Dear. Then again, it's the kind of song that would go easily with rain or a tumult of leaves. And for that matter, it's a snow that could attend an adagio for strings, the best of the Ronettes, or even George Thorogood and the Destroyers. It falls so indifferently into the spacious white parlor of the world. If I were sitting here reading in silence, reading the morning paper, or reading Being and Nothingness, not even letting the spoon touch the inside of the cup, I have a feeling the snow would even go perfectly with that.
Ruby, My Dear by Thelonious Monk, picked for us by Billy Collins, part of his Pick 3 playlist on Soundcheck today. And boy, it really, you know, now that you mention it, it does have a kind of snowy, wintry quality to it.
Yeah, it's really, and I guess I mentioned a couple of minutes ago that I write with the ear, and the poem is really has all these O's in it. You know, it's slow, solo, adagio, go.
Yeah.
It's really kind of held together by a vowel.
So the adagio, referring to Samuel Barber's adagio for strings,
probably that famous one.
Yeah,
that sad one.
So, you know, do you listen to music while you're writing?
I don't put on music any more than I put on a robe or something to write in with an ermine collar or something. It's just on often, you know, I have a poem called Nightclub, which is, I was listening to Johnny Hartman in the background, And it was very much in the background. I wasn't listening to it. But I kept hearing all these lyrics that were about, you're so beautiful and I'm a fool to be in love with you. And then I just started thinking about how common that expression is in music. So that started a poem there. So in that case, in the case of the Art Blakey, Three Blind Mice, I was actually listening. And I started writing because of the song that was actually on then. Mm. And this is the case, too, yeah.
Although with Johnny Hartman, it's different from Art Blakey or Thelonious Monk because you've got a voice. And,
yeah.
You know, we know that the brain, something pops in the brain when it hears another voice.
Yeah.
And it's a different level of intensity in the listening.
Yeah. Someone's talking to you.
Yeah. So there's a lovely touch. I mean, this poem, Envoy, is in Aimless Love, but it's also on the back flap. It's this kind of farewell to this little book that you've written, and it speaks to sort of a conundrum that I guess every creative artist deals with, which is you create the work and then you send it out there into the wide world, and at that point you're no longer responsible for what it means. It may have meant something to you, but you can't control what we're going to read into it.
No, and that's not an anxiety of mine, but it is a passage. It's a gift. It goes out to the world. But at the same time, the poet's kind of locked out of it. I mean, I can return to these poems and read them, and I'm happy to read them today on the radio. But I'm not going to go home today and start reading my own poems. You know, that would be crazy. And I get this, the poem Envoy, I say it Envoy because it's French in origin. And it was a medieval convention that you find in some French poetry. And you find it in Chaucer at the end of his long poem, Troilus and Cressida. He says, go, little book, go, mine tragedy. And it's a formal... The poet saying goodbye to his work, go out into the world. And at the end of my poem, I give the book some fatherly advice. I say, stay out as late as you like. Don't bother to call or write, and talk to as many strangers as you can. So
yeah.
That's what I want my book to do anyway.
So it's that is as I say, literally on the back flap of the new book called Aimless Love, New and Selected Poems by Billy Collins, who's been sharing with us today on Soundcheck his Pick 3 playlist, all over the map musically. And we're going to wrap up with Big Head Todd and the Monsters. Do you listen to a lot of... I mean, this is not new, but, you know, still, this is sort of, the... post-Nirvana rock period?
Yeah, well, when I was 14, rock and roll began, in 1955. And
so that was the occurrence, huh? You turned 14 and rock and roll began.
Yeah, adolescence actually started. My mother used to call me the original teenager. I don't know what to say. It's just... Big Head Todd was I didn't know about him until we went to the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville to see another singer who was headlining. I won't even mention his name, a very famous folk singer. And this group, Big Head Todd and the Monsters, opened for him and just blew the place apart. And we actually left after that because we had our musical thrill for the night. He's an amazingly captivating singer, and this song, Bittersweet, that I picked is, I think his signature song is his big hit.
All right, well, that's what we'll wrap up with. But before we do, Billy Collins, the two-term poet laureate of the United States and author of Aimless Love, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Terrific to be here with you. Thanks for the treat. Love.
A bit of bittersweet from Big Head Todd and the Monsters, shared with us by poet and author Billy Collins. Coming up, the bittersweet story of Paramount Records, as told in a sprawling 800-song box set coming out later this month. And later, the all-sweet sounds of the group Buscabuya, live in our studio. This is Soundcheck.
And I'm so glad, I am glad, I am glad, I'm glad. I'm tired of weeping.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Fans of the blues all know the legend of Robert Johnson going down to the crossroads to sell his soul to the devil. But do you know about the legend of the treasure trove of great blues recordings under the Milwaukee River? The story goes that when the great blues label Paramount Records collapsed in 1932, angry workers threw the metal masters into the river, forever tempting the most devout scuba-clad record collectors out there. Joining me in the Soundcheck studios now is Dean Blackwood, co-founder of Revenant Records. He's teamed up with Jack White to release a big two-volume box set containing thousands of long-lost Paramount recordings. The box set is called The Rise and Fall of Paramount Records. Volume 2 comes out on November 18th. Dean, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.
I'm assuming none of these were fished out of the Milwaukee River.
As far as history detectives tells us, no, they weren't able to find any.
So before we get into the myth and the reality of Paramount Records, pick a track from this enormous set that you've put together that for you kind of crystallizes why this is important.
Well, there's definitely some known quantities in among Paramount. You mentioned the Mississippi Delta, the sort of kingpin of Delta blues.
Well, we heard a little Skip James coming
right,
in.
Right, a little Skip James, Charlie Patton,
right.
your son House. But so, I would pick Lottie Kimbrough, sort of an obscure, one of these obscurities from Kansas City area. And I'd probably go with Rolling Log Blues. She's really a marvelous singer. It's strange that we don't know about her, based on her sheer output.
I've been drifting and rolling along the road, looking for my room. Dig down in the ground, gonna keep on digging till the blues come down.
A little bit of the Rolling Log Blues from one Lottie Kimbrough, one of the hidden gems uncovered in the new box set out on November 18th called The Rise and Fall of Paramount Records, Volume 2. Volume 1 dealt with the mid-20s. Volume 2 is the late 20s, early 30s, up until the fall of Paramount Records in 1932. Dean Blackwood, the co-founder of Revenant Records, which is releasing this along with Jack White's Third Man Records, is here with me on Soundcheck. So the rise of Paramount. People will be surprised to hear that Paramount Records was, in fact, an arm of the Wisconsin Chair Company. But this was not uncommon back in the 20s, right?
Right. I mean, most of these companies, like Paramount, got into the record business solely to sell something else. They
usually record players.
Yeah, record players. They wanted to sell their furniture line. In this case, Wisconsin Chair Company had done some contract manufacturing for Edison. Thomas Edison, when his factory burned down in Orange, New Jersey, he was looking for a place that could scale to his size of operation to make these phonograph cabinets that he'd been making. He got the Wisconsin Chair Company to do this right off of Lake Michigan there in Port Washington, Wisconsin. And they decided, this isn't that hard. We can make these. And then, we should make some records, too.
Yeah.
And so from 1917 to 1922, they made records that no one really cared to listen to. They assumed that it didn't really matter as long as, you know, you were producing some sort of content. It was really about the technology. It was about demonstrating for your friends the ability to play your records.
When CDs came out, there was a band called Flim and the BBs, which no one remembers except for the people who sold CD players, because Flim and the BBs was released on a CD simply so that you would have something to play on your CD player.
And it's the natural evolution of a new technology. Initially, it's about the technology, and then eventually it becomes about the content. And that was where Paramount got it wrong for about 5 years. Beginning in 1922, they started getting it right.
What was the change? What did they start doing right?
Well, they embarked on what at the time was called race records, the practice of recording black performers and producing records for black audiences. Mm-hmm. And so what you had was a company that was willing to take risks. They wanted to do things on the cheap. They were hoping to find an audience that didn't care that much about the quality of the product, the actual sound quality. Mm-hmm. They had notoriously bad-sounding records. They had no-name artists. They had bad-sounding records.
What could possibly go wrong?
and they just happened to, partly because of their, you know, they were interested in cheapness and expediency, and so they ended up with kind of the lion's share of these early jazz and blues artists because of their essentially an open-door recording policy.
And as you say, Dean, you know, they didn't much care who the performers were, how good they sounded, but in among the tuna were a few dolphins, you know, some
amazing.
Charlie Patton was one of the people that they kind of fished in, you know, brought into the studio, made recordings with. And here we have now one of the acknowledged masters of what's come to be known as country blues or Delta blues.
Right, really a generation earlier than, you know, most people, if they know of a Mississippi Delta blues artist, it's Robert Johnson. But, you know, Patton and his ilk were really a generation earlier and really served as the, you know, the foundation for you know, later 30s performers like Robert Johnson, and were a big influence on them.
And in the box set, The Rise and Fall of Paramount Records, Volume 2, which begins in 1928, we hear this Charlie Patton classic, which refers back to the flood of the
1927,
previous year.
Yeah. Right.
It's called High Water Everywhere, Part 1.
The back water done rolls around some now. Throw me down that line. Back water done rolls out down the road. Pull Charlie down that line. And I tell that water, water, don't jump through this town. Lord, now hold on. Down around country, man, it's overflow. You know, I can't see him. I'll go wild, hard, boy. I was going to the hill country, but it got me bummed. Now look at y'all now, Lila. The world rising high.
That is now considered one of the classic recordings of the Delta Blues, Charlie Patton's High Water Everywhere, Part 1. But when it was recorded, it was an unknown guy who was just part of this. I mean, it must have just been like, you know, like a sausage factory. Get him in, record them, get him out.
Yeah, there was really, they were one of the few labels that didn't require test recordings of their artists. And so that was another reason that unwittingly they tapped into this, you know, incredibly rich, you know, vein of these early vernacular musics in America.
How would was it up to the musicians to get from wherever they lived up to Wisconsin, or did they go to them?
There were some scouts in key locations, it turned out, although no one knew that at the time, right? In Mississippi, in Alabama, in Dallas, that's where, you know, a store owner there found Blind Lemon Jefferson, who had developed a big following on the streets in Dallas. And typically, you'd have a sponsor. You know, you'd have someone essentially on behalf of Paramount providing a ticket, a train ticket, to Wisconsin.
We're speaking with Dean Blackwood. He's co-founder of Revenant Records with the late guitarist John Fahey, who was a huge Charlie Patton fan. And the new box set coming out on Revenant Records in association with Jack White's label, Third Man Records, is called The Rise and Fall of Paramount Records, Volume 2. Volume 1 took us through the mid-20s, and it was 800-some-odd songs?
Right. There's 800 digital songs on each volume, and then a subset of those is contained across 6 LPs in each set as well.
Okay. So it is an enormous undertaking. And the second volume out on November 18th charts the final years of Paramount Records from 1928 to 1932. So they've got all these people coming in. Lots of them are just local, regional talents, and they, you know, they cut a couple of sides and then they go on their way and nobody really cares. But you do have Blind Lemon Jefferson. You do have Ma Rainey and Charlie Patton and, you know, King Oliver and people who turn out to be giants.
Right.
And important to say that white people were buying those records, too, at that point.
White people were, particularly the jazz records. I think the as you get into the later 20s, as they start to record more, you know, Blind Lemon Jefferson was really the signal in 1926 that there was a market for a solo vocalist with guitar playing the blues. That really, the market hadn't really been identified for that, but they had mostly focused on female blues singers, you know, up to that point. Mamie Smith, who had recorded Crazy Blues in 1920 for OK, that was a huge hit. And then, of course, you had many other female recording artists, but it was Jefferson in 26 that signaled, hey, something different is different here. And that really was an exclusively black audience, you know, for these for these solo guitar blues songs. But he was the first real superstar in this vein.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Blind Lemon Jefferson, because the song "See That My Grave Is Kept Clean" will be familiar to Bob Dylan fans. Dylan, a huge fan of Blind Lemon Jefferson, and this is from the second volume of The Rise and Fall of Paramount Records, out on November 18th.
Only one kind, babe, I ask of you. Only one kind, babe, I ask of you. Lord, it's one kind, babe, I ask of you. See that my grave is kept clean. It's a long way, got no end. It's a long
Blind Lemon Jefferson, "See That My Grave Is Kept Clean," a pretty well-known song from this old bluesman, which appears on the new box set, The Rise and Fall of Paramount Records, Volume 2, 1928 to 1932, another 800 songs from the record company catalog. And Dean, there is the story of, you know, the fall of Paramount Records. They go out of business. Why? I mean, when they're recording all of these gems, what happened?
Yeah, no, probably nothing too special. You know, they weren't equipped to ride out the Depression. I mean, 1932, you know, you're deep in the heart of it. You know, they didn't have reserves to draw upon like a company like RCA Victor had or Columbia. You know, if you look at some of these, you know, there's a few of these companies that are, you know, still around in some form today. Those are the ones who, you know, were able to ride out that particular storm.
So they end up selling their masters, which are for scrap metal.
Yeah, right, exactly. They, you know, they should never be confused with any kind of, you know, preservationist body.
Yeah.
This stuff was fleeting, you know, to them. It was moving widgets. It was what would sell this week. They had, they wouldn't even have deigned to dream that anyone would be talking about them in 100 years as some sort of purveyors of culture. You know, that wasn't a goal, wasn't an aim, and certainly wasn't any kind of dream that they had. And so, when you know the ability to produce records this week became challenged, well, they just went back to their furniture business and closed up shop on the records.
And so there's been this kind of long-lasting legend of, you know, a trove of blues and early jazz recordings lying in the silt at the bottom of the Milwaukee River.
Right.
And, you know, Amanda Petrusich, who's been on our show recently,
right.
we talked about donning scuba gear and, you know,
right.
and people do this.
That's right. That's
but
right.
No one's actually found anything.
You know, it seems unlikely at this point. That there would be anything to be found. I love the myth of it. You know that you would have you know even things like the records are you know would probably be long gone. But in theory, you could have metal you know masters, the actual stampers that were used to make records, or the original mothers that they. You know, sort of the metal versions mm-hmm. of the records themselves.
Except that's the stuff that was worth something because it was metal. So
exactly.
That's the stuff that would have been sold off.
Would have been sold off, right?
Yeah.
So it becomes increasingly unlikely.
So where did you find another 800 songs and, you know, how did you make them listenable?
Yeah, well, we had, it's a huge team and you know, key in that are Chris King, who is both a collector and a probably one of the, you know, I would say one of the leading, 78 mastering engineers. He's just very good at, you know, a lot of this is, there is some science, but it's really more art. It's artful listening. It's eking music out of a groove. I mean, he's done things like put his turntable at an angle where he thinks maybe the needle will find more music in one wall of the groove than the
yeah.
other. You know, things that it's just inventing on the fly how to eke out the sound that is, you know, it's an amazing amount of detail that's encoded in these records. I mean, the real limitations, even in a Paramount record, as bad as it sounds, the limitations are really in the materials that were used, but it doesn't mean the music's not in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And so you have to know when to leave it alone.
Right.
Right.
Well, you know, some of these recordings are super rare. We have talked on Soundcheck in the past a couple of times about Gishy Wiley and The Last Kind Words. You know, there are 3 known copies of the 78. So that's on the set, and actually we'll hear a little bit of that to wrap up. The full box set in its 800-song glory is called The Rise and Fall of Paramount Records, Volume 2, 1928 to 1932, from Jack White's Third Man Records and Dean Blackwood and late John Fahey's Revenant Records, comes out on November 18th. And Dean, a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Pleasure's mine. Thanks, John.
The last kind word I hear in my dad say, Lord, the last kind word I hear in my daddy say, if I die in the German war, I want to send my body, send it to my mother-in-law. Baggy teal, please don't bury my soul.
We go from Southern blues made in Wisconsin to Caribbean synth pop made in New York. Up next, the Brooklyn by way of Puerto Rico duo Busca Buya plays live. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In Puerto Rico, Busca Buya is Spanish slang for troublemaker. But here in New York, it's the name of a band born in Puerto Rico but based now in Brooklyn. The duo is made up of Raquel Barrios and Luis de Valle, who aren't exactly troublemakers, but they are innovators, combining vintage Caribbean sounds with electronics and dance beats, and getting a little help from the producer Dev Hines, who you may know from his own project Blood Orange. The group's first self-titled EP is out now, and Busca Buya is here with us in the Soundcheck studio to play this song for us live. It's called Cayer. The band is called Busca Buya from Brooklyn via Puerto Rico, and a live performance of the song Cayer here in our Soundcheck studio. The members of Busca Buya include Raquel Berrios, who sings and was at our piano, Luis Del Valle, who played the bass, did a bit of backing vocals. And with the two of them today, Luis Valentin on keyboards and guitar, and Abdiel Lopez behind our drum kit. Luis, Raquel, great to have you guys here.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
There is a really neat bit of kind of rhythmic misdirection in that song. You know, is it the sample? Those are the sampled percussion.
Yeah, there's a weird sample. It's like pitched in and out, and yeah.
And it's like a 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2, and then the rest of the song goes into a normal kind of 4-4.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Where's that sample come from?
Can we say?
It's super short, but it's kind of a rare psych Cuban record.
Oh, okay.
It's a short little sample.
And what does caer mean?
It means to fall.
Okay. Now, I think people will be surprised to learn that there even is Cuban psychedelia to draw on, to sample. But there is such a thing, right?
Yeah, and it's rare stuff.
And how did you discover it?
I discovered it through my dad. He used to listen to a lot of Grupo de Experimentación Sonora, which was a group in Cuba that was kind of around the time in the 60s with the Nueva Trova. So there's some records that he had at home, but then I collect vinyl, and when I started digging, I kind of found that there was even rarer stuff by that group and by that whole movement. So
there was a lot going. I mean, there was electronic music happening there in Cuba and stuff. There was all kinds of weird things that we in America never got to hear. I mean, in the States. What about, did you hear it in Puerto Rico? Your dad must have heard it, obviously.
Yeah, I think that there was a connection with Puerto Rico and Cuba, so there was. But he wasn't really into the rarer stuff. The rarer stuff I got more into because there's such a culture of people, like, digging for vinyl that, like, and that's kind of accessible. So it's kind of something that I kind of discovered, like, later on. But my dad kind of planted the seed.
It was all, and there was one studio. Was it Egrem? Was that the
Egrem
name?
Egrem was kind of a big one.
Yeah.
Yep.
So all this stuff happening in Cuba, like right under our collective noses, and we had no idea it was going on because, of course, weren't allowed to have any contact. Now, so you guys, Luis, you guys both grew up in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. In the same town, nearby?
No, actually the opposite ends of Puerto Rico. Yeah. We met here. We met in Brooklyn.
We met here in New
after
York.
We've, you know, we're born and raised in Puerto Rico.
But the band is born and raised in Brooklyn then.
Definitely.
Word, yeah, totally is.
Oh, yes.
And so, you know, you call yourselves Buscabuya, which means troublemaker, right, essentially?
Yep.
Or rabble-rouser. So, I like that one.
Rabble-rouser could be.
It just sounds nice to say.
Yeah. And is that what you feel like you guys are doing with this kind of mix of old and new, of Caribbean and Northern, et cetera?
Yeah, maybe. I feel like Buscabuya is just slang word in Spanish, and I think that our music, like a lot of the words have to do with slang, but at the same time we kind of like to combine
flip them,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we like to flip and play with like high and low, like things that are more kind of elegant and then things that are really like low from the street. So
are we going to get in trouble for any of the lyrics that you're...
You might, actually.
That
very first
today.
One that you played as you...
The first one is not bad, but it's kind of a little bit, it's kind of a little bit lewd.
Okay.
Slightly lewd.
Well, I'm going to maintain my plausible deniability here. Buscabuya is the name of the band. And the EP, I love this EP. It's short but sweet. It's like four songs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you worked with Devante Hines, who has many, many names. Blood Orange is just the most recent of them. And my understanding is that that you working with him was the result of a contest. Is that right?
Word. Yeah. We got into this crazy contest and with like Guitar Center and Converse, and we ended up winning. And
what was the contest?
Well, like part of the deal of the contest was that you would get an EP produced by Dev Hines. And
all you had to submit was like a video and like a demo or something.
Yeah.
And that's
I'm all for it because it was all this free stuff and really cool, you know, prize stuff. And Raquel was super apprehensive about it.
I was skeptical because it was in Spanish and kind of experimental. And I was like, I don't know.
But I mean, I guess he ended up liking it, you know. So, yeah, that's how it happened.
And so did you guys pretty much have the sound of these songs in mind by that point already?
We had
had most of the stuff down already. We had, we work at home. We have like a project studio at home, and that's, you know, where we sample all the stuff and record everything. So when we went to the studio, we had pretty much a like a 70%, you know, mm-hmm. their mm-hmm. kind of product. And, you know, Dev just kind of went through it and went, that's really good. That's cool. That's better. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And added guitars here and there. He's just a dude that has good taste, and you know you can kind of trust in having him lead you in the right direction. So.
For folks who don't know, Dev Hynes has been here on Soundcheck in the past under his Lightspeed Champion moniker.
Nice.
Before moving on to Blood Orange. So he helped out with the EP, and the EP is out now. And the songs are, Raquel, they are sung in Spanish.
They're all Spanish.
That's your first language, I guess.
It's our first language.
Have you considered writing in English?
Maybe. I think so. I just kind of feel like there's not so much that I could maybe contribute.
There's a landscape that, you know, it kind of has a... Our stuff has a real niche there. You
right.
know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like.
Are you suggesting that there's more than one English speaking band in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
And that the scene might
there
be
might
a
be.
Little bit crowded?
Yeah, yeah. It might be. The market might be a little
it
flooded.
It makes it more special.
Yeah. Obviously, lots going on in the Puerto Rican music scene, and a little bit of it going on right here in Brooklyn with the band Busca Bulla. Raquel, Luis, it's been great having you and the guys here playing for us
Same.
Today. Thank
awesome,
you so much.
Man. Thank you.
You have a song to play us out with?
Yeah,
yes.
We're going to go out with a bang, with Sono.
Sono, and what does that mean? Does it just sound? Or?
Yeah, Sono is kind of like, it's like past tense that you, something like, it's a sound, but
it
in past tense.
It did sound.
It did sound, or something like
something
that.
Something
yeah.
sounded.
Okay. Yeah.
It sounds better in Spanish.
So
yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry to ask you to sort of take all the magic
yeah,
out
totally.
Of it by
Thanks,
pulling
man.
It apart like that. Let's hear the song. The band is Busca Bulla. And their self-titled EP is out now. The song is called Sono. It's Busca Bulla live on Soundcheck. band is Busca Buya. Their self-titled EP is out now. It includes that song, Sono. Tomorrow on the show, saloons, gin joints, watering holes, pubs. The bar has played an outsized role in the creative lives of writers and musicians. And we'll talk with writer Sean Manning about some of the greatest boozy haunts the world over. And New York bartender and writer Rosie Schapp will tell us how to soundtrack our drinking experience. Also, we'll find out why the Mr. Softy ice cream song still makes you feel like a kid. It's one of the many secrets revealed in a new book about how sound makes us think and feel and buy. We'll talk to the authors about how hospital noise makes us sick and why Iggy Pop is a remarkably effective salesman. Plus, the buzzy, fuzzy, garagey trio X-Hex visits the studio to play a few songs from their great new record. All of that tomorrow. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.